This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister says the country has preserved its political independence and made great scientific and economic achievements despite extensive sanctions. The US is to announce about $3 billion in military assistance for Ukraine as Germany pledges $500 million in military aid package. And a former US police detective pleads guilty to providing false information to obtain a search warrant that led to the killing of a black woman in 2020.
Hello and welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us.
Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister says the country has preserved its political independence and succeeded in making economic and scientific progress despite the brutal sanctions. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a meeting with Asima Goïta, the head of Mali's transitional government in Bamako. He said Iran is determined to develop defense, economic, trade, scientific and technological cooperation with Mali. Goïta, for his part, welcomed the expansion of bilateral ties. He praised Iran's achievements in the face of sanctions and its important status in global political and economic developments. He said the people in Mali regard Iran as a role model and keep up their struggle against the excessive demands of foreign countries. The Iranian foreign minister also says the interference by foreign states in the affairs of West Asian and African countries is the reason behind the emergence of some terrorist groups in these regions. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also censured the West for using terrorism as a tool to serve its own interests. The top Iranian diplomat made the remarks in a joint presser with his Malian counterpart in Bamako. He noted that Iran supports dialogue rather than sanctions to resolve problems in African countries. He said Washington's, quote, cruel sanctions against Iran have proved that the West's use of sanctions is a failed policy. The Malian foreign minister, for his part, denounced sanctions and called them destructive measures. Abdoulaye Diop said his country is also against foreign interference in the affairs of the regional countries. Amin Abdullahian arrived in Mali on Tuesday on the first leg of his African tour, which will also take him to Tanzania and Zanzibar.
Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian is in the Malian capital, Bamako, on the first leg of his African tour, which will later take him to Tanzania and Zanzibar. Amir Abdullahian is heading a high-ranking political and economic delegation. A group of representatives of several private sector companies also accompanies him during his visit. The top diplomat was welcomed by his Malian counterpart, Abdoulaye Diop. Upon arrival at Bamako's international airport, the Malian foreign minister called the visit a sign of Iran's will to enhance ties with the African country. Amir Abdullahian confirmed that Tehran seeks all-out expansion of relations with Mali and has special plans for this purpose.
I am confident that we will start a new chapter of relations between Tehran and Mali under the government of President Raisi.
The visit is part of a wider policy roadmap in Iran. The foreign ministry says Tehran is looking to expand ties with African nations, including Mali, in the fields of economy, banking, and trade.
The United States is to announce a new batch of military aid to Ukraine worth about $3 billion. This as Russia keeps warning about the consequences of weapons supply to Kiev. U.S. officials say the package is expected to be announced on Wednesday, which is the day the war in Ukraine hits the six-month mark and the country celebrates its Independence Day. This will be the single largest aid package to be received by Kiev since the war began on February 24th. It will bring nearly $14 billion, the total amount of military assistance the Pentagon has offered ever since. Germany has also pledged a further $500 million aid in military for Ukraine. Berlin's package will be delivered next year. It includes anti-aircraft systems, military vehicles, and rocket launchers. Russian officials say such shipments, only add fuel to the fire of war and prolong the conflict. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky vows to take back the Crimean Peninsula when Kiev sees fit. He says Ukraine will not consult other countries before doing so. Zelensky made the comments at a news conference in Kiev, where the leaders of dozens of countries and international organizations had gathered. Zelensky said Russian forces must be forced to leave the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. He said there has to be political pressure on Moscow. Ukraine has used Western-supplied weapons to target Russian supply lines, while Kiev has pledged to conduct a major offensive in the south. The remarks follow a spate of explosions in Crimea in recent weeks. Ukraine has not claimed responsibility for any of the blasts. Crimea is located along the northern coast of the Black Sea. It voted in a 2014 referendum to break off from Ukraine and rejoin Russia. A former Louisville detective has pleaded guilty of providing false information to obtain a search warrant for Breonna Taylor's home that led to a 2020 raid in which the black woman was fatally shot. Kelly Goodlett admitted to conspiring with another ex-detective to falsify the warrant and making untrue statements to cover up the fake affidavit. Goodlett faces up to 5 years in prison, a fine of $250,000, and 3 years of supervised release. Goodlett and two other officers were facing federal charges for falsifying the warrant. This, as a fourth was charged with using excessive force by opening fire during the raid. The killing of Taylor, along with the killings of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, made, among others, sparked outrage and galvanized protests that peaked in the intensity of the summer of 2020. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has held his country's ties with Syria. He says Moscow strongly condemns Israeli strikes against Syria. We discussed the issue during our news review program earlier. Let's take a listen to see what our guests had to say.
It's time for a news review. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country strongly condemns Israel's missile attacks against Syria.
We have strongly condemned Israel's dangerous practice of strikes on Syrian territory, including the very disturbing episode of the attack on Damascus International Airport on June 10th, followed by attacks on the port of Tartus. We demand that Israel respect the resolution of the UN Security Council and above all respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic.
Lavrov made the comments in a joint presser with his visiting Syrian counterpart Faisal Megdad in Moscow. The top Russian diplomat hailed ties with Syria and said that Moscow would continue support for the Arab country in the fight against terrorism. In response to a question about Turkey's preparations for a new operation in northern Syria, Lavrov said that no such action should be allowed there.
As for the question of how the situation in the north of Syria may develop, the main thing is that no new military actions should be allowed. Negotiations should take place via diplomatic channels on the basis of political principles that existed in relations between Syria and Turkey before.
The Russian foreign minister says that any kind of escalation in Syria would be unacceptable. Lavrov also accused U.S.-led Western countries of complicating the situation around the world with their aggressive policies. He said the West is adopting colonial policies toward the Middle East and North Africa, as well as in Ukraine and its surrounding areas. Lavrov also thanked Syria for its recognition of Ukraine's Brekhiver, Luhansk, and Donetsk People's Republics. The top Syrian diplomats also conveyed serious support for the Russian military operation in Ukraine. Megdad is leading a delegation which will hold talks on bilateral and international issues. Cannot let me invite a couple of guests to get some insight into this. So Mohammed Ali, our correspondent, joining me from Damascus. Also with us is Elijah Magnier, who's a journalist and political analyst, joining us from Marseille, France. Welcome to the show, Jim. Now, Mohammed, tell us what's going on in Syria about the latest Israeli airstrike there and also this visit that's taking place between the foreign ministers.
Yes, of course. We all know that Israel has been attacking Syria with airstrikes for many years. This has been, of course, condemned by Syria. Always letters are sent to the United Nations Security Council calling on that international body by Syria to shoulder its responsibility in perhaps protecting and preserving international peace and security. What is new today, perhaps, is that we have some new stances coming out from both foreign ministers of Syria and Russia. It was not a new stance by Russia of condemning such Israeli attacks, but perhaps it's a reiteration of the strong stance of Russia against such Israeli attacks, in which Lavrov expressed concern over such aggression and also condemned such attacks, calling on Israel to respect Syria's sovereignty. Now, also perhaps one of the most important topics discussed recently, most important developments are the prospects of restoration of relations between Syria and Turkey. And there, Mr. Lavrov said that Russia has been exerting efforts to restore such relations between the two countries for years, and that any agreement should be reached through diplomatic channels. Now, with regards to what Syria's foreign minister Faisal Miqdad said, he said that Syria regards it as very important, those efforts exerted by both Russia and Iran in order to solve this perhaps dispute or problems between Syria and Turkey. But however, if this agreement should be reached, the Turkish occupation of Syria must end, meaning in the northern part of Syria, and that there should be no terrorism in Syria and no terrorism in Turkey, which means al-Maqdad was saying that Turkey must end its support to terrorist groups.
Okay. Now, Elijah, some observers we're talking to are saying that Moscow's just recently adopted much harsher and more straightforward and frank stances regarding condemning different policies and strategies adopted by the West. And now we are seeing that Mr. Lavrov is strongly condemning the Israeli attack against Syria. Tell us about how significant this could be.
It's not significant, really, because either Russia doesn't understand the way Israel operates or is not serious enough to stop the Israeli aggression and violation of Syrian sovereignty. The Israelis have carried out 1,500 attacks against Syria since 2011 and at least 1,000 since 2015 when Russia landed in Syria. Moreover, the Russians have the S-300 and S-400 anti-air missiles that can provide the Syrian armed forces with the deterrence capability against the Israelis' aggression. If Russia is not allowing the Syrian government to use it and to hunt down any Israeli violation of the Syrian territory and sovereignty, so all the talks serve for nothing, really. Condemning the attack, there are over 180 UN resolutions against Israel regarding Palestine, and Israel is not moving and doesn't care about the UN resolution. So condemning Israel and saying this is a violation of the Syrian territory is just saying the obvious, but not changing the policy.
Okay, Elijah, could it kind of have anything to do with the recent stances that the Israeli officials have adopted regarding the Ukraine war, and they have had some comments, anti-Moscow comments? I mean, how related could this be? And do you foresee maybe some kind of, are the two countries moving on a collision course probably?
We have seen some indication from Russia of changing some of the very soft approach toward Israel by closing, for example, the Jewish Office of Coordination in Moscow and directing a harsher language toward Israel. However, we've seen the Israelis sending military equipment to Ukraine, special forces to Ukraine, training the Ukrainian, and standing harshly against the Russian war in Ukraine. Therefore, there is no balance between what the Israelis are doing as anti-Russian behavior and steps And the response from Russia has always been extremely shy. Even if it is unusual for the silent Russia to say something, however, it's still not enough. The Russians, if they are taking gradual steps, Israel doesn't understand that. Israel is stopped only by deterrence, tit for tat. If the Israelis attack, the Syrians respond with a strong capability. This is the language that Israel understands.
Okay, thanks for that. Mohammed Ali in Damascus, Elijah Magnier in Marseille.
Iraq's judiciary says it will resume work on Wednesday after Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr called on his followers to withdraw from outside the judiciary's premises. Iraq's Supreme Judicial Council has suspended activities on Tuesday after Sadr's supporters camped out near its building. They demanded that the judiciary dissolve parliament. Later in the day, Sadr asked his supporters to withdraw, but the cleric urged the protesters to continue their sit-in outside parliament. Sadr's followers, called Sadrists, have been there for weeks. They are preventing the formation of a government by rival Shia parties nearly 10 months after Iraq's elections. Sadr called for the dissolution of parliament and early elections after withdrawing his lawmakers from parliament in June. In the meantime, Iraq's popular mobilization forces say they are ready to defend the government branches, particularly the judiciary. The forces have also asked the caretaker government to take up responsibility to protect the state bodies. Elsewhere, the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says his country's top priority is to fight the US-backed Saudi-led coalition that launched a war on Yemen in 2015. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the current UN-brokered ceasefire between Saudi Arabia and Yemen must be used to inform people about the danger of aggressors. He said foreign forces and their backers in Yemen are pillaging the country's gas and oil resources. The resistance leader underlined the need to take back what has been robbed from the Yemeni people.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. 100 days after the killing of journalist Shirin Abu Aghla, the Biden administration has failed to launch an investigation. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alice Sperry, writer. This article is published under the heading, Biden ignores the injustice of Israeli regime killing of a Palestinian-American journalist. Here's the story. Days after Israeli regime forces killed Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghla, the Biden administration has made no concrete effort to secure accountability for her killing, nor has it moved to independently investigate it despite dozens of members of Congress calling on the administration to do so. Abu Aqile, an Al Jazeera journalist and a household name across the West Asia region, was killed on May 11th while reporting on an Israeli regime military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. She was shot in the head while wearing a clearly visible press vest, standing nowhere near the fighting that had taken place earlier that morning. The killing was swiftly condemned by human rights and press freedom groups across the world. Within weeks, half a dozen independent investigations, including one by the United Nations, concluded that the bullet that killed her came from Israeli regime forces, with the UN noting that it had been well aimed. But U.S. officials have yet to take any concrete action over the killing by the Zionist regime of a U.S. citizen, and it's unclear whether they have any plans to do so. Last month, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with members of Abu Aqile family in Washington, D.C. after the request to meet President Joe Biden during his July trip to the West Asia region went unanswered. Blinken made no commitments to them other than greater transparency and more direct communication, which he promised after the family members noted that they were learning of U.S. statements on the killing from the news rather than directly from U.S. officials. Lina Abu Aqile, Shirin's niece, told The Intercept in an interview recently, "There were no promises made, no commitments. We expressed our concern. We expressed our disappointment with the way the United States has been handling the killing of Shirin, and we express how ridiculous it is that the family of a U.S. citizen still has to ask the U.S. to do the bare minimum. There wasn't anything of substance." Blinken told the family that their most pressing request, an independent U.S. investigation of the killing, was outside the scope of the State Department's authority and that he could not refer the case to the Justice Department, which would need to authorize such an inquiry. Abu Aqile said, "The entire time there was a lot of deflection, a lack of answer." Since the visit with Blinken, the family has not heard from him, and despite his reassurances that he would keep them informed, they learned from the news that he had asked the Israeli regime to expedite a conclusion to its own investigation. "But that's not what we ask him," said Abu Aqile, adding, "because we know how that's going to turn out. We are not expecting anything from the Israelis. What we are expecting is the U.S. to do its job." The U.S. State Department did not respond to a request for comment. The Justice Department declined to comment. While in Washington last month, the Abu Aqiles also met with more than a dozen members of Congress, several of whom spoke publicly in support of the family's quest for justice. Those meetings followed a flurry of statements and legislative efforts in the weeks and months since Abu Aqile's killing. To date, such efforts have included a letter led by Democratic representatives Andre Carson of Indiana, Lou Correa of California, and Bill Pascrell of New Jersey, signed by 57 members of Congress calling on the U.S. State Department and FBI to investigate the killing, as well as a similar letter by Senator Chris Van Hollen and 23 other senators. After the U.S. State Department issued a widely criticized statement on the killing over the July 4th holiday, Van Hollen and others issued a new letter, asking a detailed list of questions about the U.S. government's response to the killing. Separately, Democratic senators Cory Booker and Bob Menendez of New Jersey, where Abu Aghaleh had been a resident, also sent a letter requesting a senior-level classified briefing on the investigation details, including American involvement. Meanwhile, Carson introduced an amendment to the defense budget, supported by other progressive members of Congress, seeking to enforce a U.S. investigation into Abu Aghaleh's killing and any U.S. defense material implicated in it. After that failed, Carson announced standalone legislation seeking the same outcome. While these proposals aim to force the U.S. government to address Abu Aghaleh's killing, they are fairly limited in scope and don't address broader systematic human rights violations by the Zionist regime that the U.S. government could also address under existing U.S. laws, including foreign assistance and arms exports legislation. Abu Aghalehs are not the first American family dealing with the U.S. government's inaction in the aftermath of a killing by Israeli regime forces. Last month, The Intercept published a long feature about the years-long crusade by the family of Rachel Corey, an American peace activist killed in Gaza in 2003, to lobby U.S. officials for justice in vain. The Coreys chose to break their silence about their private conversations with U.S. officials precisely because they feared that Abu Aghaleh family would be forced to endure the same ordeal. They shouldn't have to be asking the exact same questions we were asking in 2003, Sarah Corey, Rachel's sister, told Intercept, adding, "My question to Biden administration is, what are you doing differently for Shireen's family that you didn't do in our case so that they will get accountability?" After their meetings in Washington last month, the Abu Aghalehs felt that they had strong allies on the Hill, Lina Abu Aghaleh said. But so far, there has been no progress. The statements of support marked significant momentum around a cause that many in Washington have long been reticent to embrace, but they are only statements for now. "We told the family, after this trip, everything's just going to come to a screening halt, and it's going to be on us to build it back up again," said Brad Parker, a legislative consultant at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has been working with Abu Aghaleh to coordinate meetings with U.S. officials, adding, "These narrow events over the years since Rachel's killing created these moments where it feels like there is this really significant step forward on the policy front, but then it doesn't really translate into concrete action. This is maybe the biggest test." For their part, the Abu Aghalehs plan to continue to lobby the U.S. government for action with what Lina Abu Aghaleh described as a mixture of skepticism and hope. If the U.S. does not want to conduct an investigation, what does this say? It gives the green light for other governments to target U.S. citizens, U.S. journalists, without any accountability? Our hope right now lies in the hands of the members of Congress who have the power to make a change. So, in a way, we are hopeful, but the U.S. could have done something from day one, and they chose not to do.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, and to you too.
Dear listeners, Brother Miqdad is Islamic researcher and teacher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always. All right, so we had been talking about some pros and cons that we can teach to our teenagers about social media. We discussed about pros, we discussed about some of the cons, and there were some of the cons that were still remaining. We talked about the wastage of time, we talked about deliberate self-esteem, feeling less productive due to the usage of social media. What else can we teach to our teenagers?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, in relation to this correlation between social media usage and a serious decrease in self-esteem, we talked about the feeling of being unproductive, feeling no results. Another reason why this happens is having false role models or this idea that we compare ourselves with others.
Okay.
This can be in the field of the physical body, so body image and how we look. We compare our looks with others. We compare our beauty with others, our body shape with others, but also role models in other spheres, or how much people have gained more money, what do they do in their lives, what they've achieved, etc., etc. This creates fake goals in our lives, fake and false aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do this comparison, it leads us to feel very negative about ourselves, because always we look at the positive. Obviously, social media, a lot of time, especially when it comes to influencers and the people who are the authorities over the social media,
okay,
they portray an image, an idea out there that most people can't achieve, you can say, right? And so this leads us to have an ideal in our mind to think, okay, this is what my body should look like. This is how beautiful I should be, or this is how much money I should be earning. Or this is kind of the reputation, the fame I should have.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't have all of this, and I've seen it in other people on social media, I feel really bad about myself. I feel that I'm not worthy. I feel that I can't do it. I feel that I'm not good enough, and that nobody loves me.
Yeah.
Because I compare myself to people who have 100,000 followers, and I only have 2,000. So this leads to an extreme level of negative self-esteem.
And you know, when even there are some advertisements about some work, like if some people are working and then they are posting, then they're comparing. And then when you as a viewer are seeing all those things, like I saw many women going towards like to go for microneedling or other stuff without the fact that they were in need of this, like this kind of treatment, like those who had very good and fair skin and without any, without any scars. Even those went and for microneedling and other kind of treatments, which are like laser treatments or other beauty treatments. So this is all because of that lowered self-esteem that the social media has caused.
Yes, that's all correct. Right.
I think there are more cons we can talk about, and we definitely get ourselves educated about the cons first as parents, and then only we can educate our teenagers about these cons so that they can make more productive use out of it and they can like actually not waste their time. Brother, I'll continue the discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a better game! IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we're talking about the cons of social media and how can we guide our teenagers about that. Yes, brother.
So this self-esteem is a very important discussion, because today you find teenagers, girls and boys, going through depression, going through anxiety, affecting their lives, being affected by how they see and how they perceive themselves, how okay. they see their achievements and their goals in lives. And this is very much tampered by social media and what they see on social media. And so this is a very important negative point about social media, because it gives us ideals out there. It makes us compare with others without us thinking about our own circumstance, thinking about our own conditions, thinking about what really is ideal in our life, and which is the true perfection that we need to achieve.
I also was going through one of the studies which showed that the jealousy factor that increases in people is because of the excessive use of social media. Because mostly people, whenever they post about like the happy life, or they pretend to be happy, or they give good poses. They mostly do not pose about the sad things or upsetting things that are happening in their lives. And you as a viewer, when you're viewing them, you are comparing the upset part of your life with the better part they are posting. So this contributes to jealousy, and that factor develops within you unconsciously.
Exactly. In addition to that is this whole concept and idea of being narcissistic, right?
Okay.
Social media makes us very narcissistic. Narcissistic means that we are very much concerned about ourselves only.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we post photos of ourselves with plenty of filters, this idea of self-love. We're obsessed of receiving praise,
mm-hmm.
right? You find that today teenagers, they're obsessed with, say something about me. Tell me I look good. Give me a thumbs up. Give me a like.
Mm-hmm.
Comment forward my image. I'll put loads of different images of myself just to get this kind of praise from people. And these are usually very fake praise. Nowadays, if you put a thumbs up on a social media, or if you put a like, it really doesn't mean anything. It's very fake. Even if you don't like it, you'll still, or as I say, even if you're not laughing, you'll still say lol, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't laughing at all, but
you'll still write it.
You'll still write it.
Yeah.
So these are all fake praise that we're so thirsty for because of this love that we have for ourselves. And this self-love at an exaggerated way is extremely negative, because it's empty. It's a bubble. It's a false bubble, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever something happens in our life, suddenly a challenge comes, suddenly somebody says something to us, or suddenly we're faced with a difficult moment, this bubble pops. And this leads us to depression. This leads us to
anxiety,
being suicidal, and et cetera, et cetera.
Giving up with life, actually.
Exactly.
Yes, that's happening so much, actually, with our teenagers. And what can we do to help that? And what are more cons? We'll talk about that after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, Allah will write a reward for he who kisses his child, and Allah will bring happiness on Judgment Day to he who makes his child happy.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother McThought, and we're talking about the cons of social media and how we can educate our teenagers about these cons. Yes, Brother, you said that self-esteem is a really, really big discussion, and social media is doing a lot to lower that self-esteem.
So I suggest that you check out studies about the relationship between social media and stress, anxiety, depression, obesity, eating disorder, etc., etc., and you'll see the different correlations out there. Another negative about social media and how it impacts our lives is that social media leads to decrease in social skills. So you find that many of our youth, teenagers, are very much talking to people at a social level, at a social media level. But when it comes for them to talk and have the maturity to have a conversation with elders in a work environment or in a different
professional
setup,
way.
Exactly. They lack the social skill. They lack the ability and the maturity to be able to, and I'm not just saying just having a conversation, even that is there as well. Some youth can't even have a proper conversation.
Okay.
But they lack the maturity to how to deal with conversation, how to deal with people on a real basis.
Okay.
I remember there are certain teens that would tell me that I can't even make a phone call, right? I'd rather text. I'll do everything by text and WhatsApp messages, but I can't make a phone call.
All right.
And these are not kids. These are 16, 18-year-olds. So
teenagers.
It's exactly. So social media has an impact on the way we have our interaction. But even worse than all this is that when it comes to true social relationship, so for example, in a marriage setup or relationship as from fathers and children, so for these teenagers in the future that they want to build families, very poor social ability to have relationship because of social media, because we're so used to this, because youth are so used to this type of relationship that we have on social media, which is a very fake, very shallow, very distant relationship, right? Because you can't build a true relationship on social media. The human being requires physical relationship. And the relationship that we have on social media is a very fake one, a very shallow one. It doesn't have any maturity to it. It's just at the level of a few words or a few sentences. You don't build
really
a true relationship.
Really even mean that sometimes.
Yeah. You can't rely on a person on social media. You can't build a family on social media. Obviously, there's. I'm not going to discuss the social aspect of it, but it's quite clear that. And so individuals that spend so much time on this, for them to then grow up and have the ability to build a true relationship is difficult, and they struggle building a true relationship, a true physical relationship, because of this time that they spend on social media and this how they've adapted to this
kind of environment.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there seems to be a lot like where teenagers struggle, be that in terms of conversation, be that acting mature, be that like being productive, be that time management. It seems that teenagers are lacking everywhere because of the cons. And educating them more about cons, it seems to be more important. Inshallah, I'll continue the discussion with you in next session. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. Until another session. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of all.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
While UK Conservative leadership candidates Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak are committed to the UK's legally binding target for net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, both want to curtail solar power and onshore wind farms and support fracking and increase fossil fuel production. While Rishi Sunak has promised government support for Insulation 2, neither has set out a detailed plan on the issue or on net zero generally. We have prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey under the heading, Think Tank Says Tory Leadership Candidates Failing on Net Zero Policies. Right-leaning think tank has warned that the two UK Conservative leadership candidates are failing to promise the policies needed to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions, despite a clear need for measures that would cut consumer bills as well as carbon emissions. According to a proposal from Onward, insulating Britain's drafty homes would cost the government just over £1 billion a year in grants, plus a similar amount in subsidised loans, while a 50% cut in the stamp duty could encourage people to install low-carbon heat pumps when they move homes. Ministers could also increase the uptake of electric vehicles and other green technologies through salary sacrifice schemes and reduce the number of car journeys through nudges such as personalised public transport plans that inform people of their local public transport timetables and cycle routes. However, while both Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak are committed to the UK's legally binding target of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, both want to curtail solar power and onshore wind farms and support fracking and increase fossil fuel production. While Rishi Sunak has promised government support for Insulation 2, neither has set out a detailed plan on the issue or on net zero generally. Alex Luke, author of the Onward report, said it was natural that the candidates were focused on immediate issues such as the cost of living crisis, but said the quest for net zero must be a key priority for the next Prime Minister. Alex Luke said both candidates claim they are committed to the net zero target, but we need to hear more from both of them on how exactly they will do that. Alex Luke added, it's clear that retrofit of homes for energy efficiency will need to be a massive part of reaching the net zero target. He pointed out that polling showed net zero was still a top 5 issue for most Tory voters and a top 4 issue for the wider public. The Onward report, Going Green, which will be published in the coming days, found that an insulation programme for 15 million households offering a combination of government grants and loans subsidised with very low interest rates through the government's infrastructure bank would cost the Treasury about £31 billion in total by 2050, plus another £40 billion in total by 2075 in subsidising low-interest rate loans. Homeowners who save about £20 a month on their bills after the cost of repaying the loans each month at current energy prices, and far more if prices leap again, as expected this autumn and next spring. Alex Luke said a previous attempt to do this, the Green Deal programme introduced under the coalition government but scrapped in 2015, had failed owing to astronomical market-based interest rates of more than 10%, which meant people barely saw any overall saving. Onward also suggested that nudges could play a key role in changing consumer behaviour, which will be needed to reach net zero emissions. Alex Luke said local authorities could offer personalised transport and commute plans. He pointed to a trial in Ipswich, Suffolk, costing £27 a person, which gives personalised information on public transport, walking and cycling routes, which resulted in an 11% fall in car journeys and a 14% increase in walking and cycling. Alex Luke adds, none of these nudges are a panacea or an excuse for not thinking seriously about investment in reaching net zero emissions, but they are small-scale interventions that are low-cost, that have an impact and bring about changes. The government pulled the plug on its incentives to buy electric cars earlier this year, resulting in an uncertain outlook for the sector. According to Alex Luke, take-up of the cars had increased markedly, but they are likely to remain more expensive to buy than fossil fuel cars for the next decade. A government spokesperson claimed, the United Kingdom is leading the world on climate change. We have driven down emissions by 44% since 1990, whilst growing our economy more than any other G7 country, and are taking action to help people make greener choices. He asserted, we have committed over £6.6 billion to decarbonise homes and buildings, which includes a £450 million boiler upgrade scheme to increase the uptake of heat pumps. Further, we have invested £2.5 billion to accelerate the rollout of zero-emission vehicles and charging infrastructure across the country. Furthermore, as concerns over climate, pollution and biodiversity have been largely absent from the United Kingdom leadership debates, the Green Party has warned the two candidates to be the UK's next Prime Minister must commit to much tougher environmental targets and environmental policies. Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak have both confirmed their commitment to the UK's legally binding target of reaching net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, but have given little indication of how they would go about this goal. Adrian Ramsay, the co-leader of the Green Party, warned that the United Kingdom was already living beyond its means on the environment by consuming far more resources than the planet could sustain, damaging nature beyond its capacity to recover and emitting far more carbon dioxide than could be absorbed by trees, seas and soils. Policy pronouncements by the two leadership candidates so far have focused on the economy and issues such as immigration. But Ramsay says pursuing economic growth at all costs was not possible without damaging the Earth's life support systems. He warned, just recently, the United Kingdom witnessed the hottest temperatures on record, and the consequence of climate disruption became clear for all to see. As wildfires raged and people lost everything as their homes were burnt on the ground, the two candidates to become our next Prime Minister were talking more about economic growth than tackling the climate crisis. Ramsay called for a shift away from standard economic measures, such as gross domestic product, which rewards the overuse of resources and fails to account for factors such as people's well-being and people's happiness. Ramsay said, "Unfortunately, successive governments have for too long focused on economic growth at all costs, without acknowledging that it's the quality of our economy that matters most, not just the quantity. A narrow focus solely on economic growth will exacerbate the climate crisis and worsen social inequalities." Many economists are unhappy with gross domestic product as the sole benchmark of success in the economy and have called for a broader suite of measures that would take into account people's well-being and the impact of human activities on the planet. Ramsay said making changes to the way the United Kingdom's success was measured would benefit everyone. He said this requires a shift away from chasing economic growth only and instead measuring the success of our economy by how it maximises people's happiness without exceeding planetary boundaries. It also means policies to tackle the scourge of inequality and ensure we share the Earth's resources fairly. He also pointed to estimates of Earth Overshoot Day, the date when humanity has used all the biological resources that the planet can regenerate within a year. All resources used beyond this point are beyond what the Earth can naturally sustain, and all carbon dioxide emitted from this point is not absorbed but pours into the atmosphere to keep heating the planet for up to a century. Ramsay said, "I'm calling on the Conservative leadership candidates to commit to broadening their focus from economic growth and show how they will ensure that the UK lives within our planetary means within the next 10 years. He added, "Our government should be working across the board to ensure we're leading the way on pushing back Earth Overshoot Day further every year."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is I.